This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Saturday Magazine, sponsored by Velocity Rewards,
your award-winning loyalty program for Virgin Australia's frequent flyers.
Hey, you. Yeah, you, on the job site. Did you know that a big portion of people who listen to Joy at work, just like you? Right now, times are very tough financially, and without your support, Joy may not be around to help you through your work day. So tell your workmates, your next door neighbour, and even your mum to head over to joy.org.au and help us build Joy Nation by making a donation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
A unique mix of world news and queer culture. Saturday Magazine. Every Saturday, 10 till 12 on Joy 94.9.
Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9. Fiona, Paul, Macca and Tass.
Thanks, Macca.
And our podcaster, Gordon.
Of course. And also, Macca, we keep on forgetting this, but we do need to encourage people to subscribe on iTunes and remember to rate and review our podcasts.
Of course.
I've actually never said that on here before, so we need to keep on saying that.
Well, you will be taken out and punished.
So, our next guest is, our first guest this morning, of course, is Misha Ketchell, who's the editor of The Conversation. If you don't follow The Conversation, you should. Subscribe, it's very easy. It's actually free, but of course, donations are always welcomed. And you get a daily burst of really good stuff to read. Good morning to you, Misha.
Good morning.
Just a little plug there so that everybody knows where you're from. And, of course, The Conversation features evidence-informed articles, usually about 1,000-word essay style, aren't they, Misha?
Yes, and the most significant thing is they're written only by experts who are writing in the area of expertise. So it's really about trying to inform the public. Not so much about sort of propagating different opinions, but providing really good quality information.
And you also take multiple perspectives, so they're not always going to be a left perspective, so to speak. You'll also have a middle-of-the-road perspective and a right perspective.
Yes, and I guess not everything falls on that sort of political spectrum. So, for example, this week one of the things we did was analysis of is pornography usage bad for your health? Where we asked 5 different experts, and 3 felt that pornography usage is totally fine, and a couple had a couple of issues. So we're trying to sort of survey a wide range of expert opinion on all topics.
I have to say that I do follow The Conversation pretty closely because it's often not only very current but very informative and evidence informed, which is what I always enjoy.
Because you see, Tass is a fact magnet.
Fact magnets. Thanks, Macca. So, Misha, I'm interested in your reflections on what's occurring in Melbourne in particular at the moment with the general lockdown as a response to trying to suppress infection with and the spread of the infection, the COVID-19 infection. What are your reflections? How do you think it's all travelling at the moment?
The first thing to say is, you know, it's been a very tough week for everybody in Melbourne. The sort of psychological impact of going backwards is very different to going through an initial phase where you sort of are telling yourself, at some point this will be over and we'll come out the other side. When you think you're coming out the other side and then you have this, you know, significant retreat, I think it's really impacted on a lot of people's sort of mental health, sense of well-being, the overall feeling within Melbourne and within Victoria. As part of that, we've seen in the political process some attempts to point fingers and lay blame. And I have questions about whether that's the appropriate thing to be doing right now. There are legitimate questions about parts of the ways that the Victorian government has handled this that do need to be asked and do need to be debated. But I also think that there's a little bit of finger-pointing that is somewhat counterproductive in what's happening, when really right now what we need to do is all focus on working together and getting through this process. And also, I mean, my own personal view is that to some extent there is an element of just pure bad luck in this, in that, you know, there are certainly criticisms that could be made of the government or the Victorian Health Department, some of the ways things have been handled. But at the end of the day, we've got a very virulent virus, which, you know, there can be outbreaks. And some of that is arbitrary and some of that is luck. And that's just the reality. So you don't want to necessarily stigmatise those people who have been victims of outbreaks. For example, this particular school where there's been a very bad outbreak and there's been some attempts at criticism of the school. And, you know, my own personal view is that school was unlucky. You know, there's not sort of particular evidence that it was negligent in its sort of health practices. So that sort of seems to be where we're at right now. There's been a lot of stuff about the towers and the lockdown of the towers and the policing of the towers, which raises a whole bunch of other bigger, broader issues around public housing and the way we treat and resource public housing, social disadvantage, the fairness of that policy. I mean, the towers that are locked down are public housing towers. There are a lot of other people in towers in close proximity who weren't locked down. A lot of people have made good points about some of those issues. But I do think that overall, if you look at the response, it has been driven by a predominant desire to protect public health. And although there's errors and issues along the way, I think you've got to bear that in mind.
Did you see the article in The Age by Professor Lindsay Grayson, by any chance?
I did. And I saw the follow-up editorial today as well.
I must go and have a look at those. So Lindsay Grayson was an infectious diseases specialist. He worked at some of our big tertiary centres at both the Austin and Monash. And he was very critical of changes that have occurred in the health department. Perhaps you might like to just give us a very quick update on that.
So his argument was predominantly about the way in which it's structured, so the role of the chief health officer and the chief medical officer. And he was basically arguing that a few things had happened in the Victorian Health Department, one of which was a sort of a decentralisation of control, so that there was more autonomy within individual hospitals, and he argued that that had weakened the power of those two roles and the way in which those two roles operated, and it led to sort of bureaucratic failures. He was at pains to point out that he felt that the individuals in the system were doing a very good job, including the chief medical officer in Victoria, chief health officer. He was arguing that, you know, overall there's a lot of good people working very hard in the system, but the system is under-resourced and poorly structured, was his argument. And The Age sort of repeated or referred back to that today in the editorial sort of that was looking forward to this sort of, you know, laying of blame and responsibility and sort of where we go from here. Personally, I'm not well acquainted enough with the inner workings of the Victorian Health Department to know how well-founded those criticisms are. Taz, I'm interested, actually, do you have any thoughts on that?
Look, perhaps I do. I might just reserve my comments for the moment.
I guess there's always questions about resourcing. But having said that, the flip side of that is what we're dealing with is, you know, a once-in-a-100-year event. And not every system is going to be set up for that or resourced, you know, in a way that's going to anticipate that. So,
look, I agree with you on that. I agree with you on that, Misha. And I get a little bit annoyed with people who just want to point the finger and lay blame and actually just not, you know, literally get off their seat and act in the most appropriate way. It's very easy to criticise. And I've seen that happening, in the political space in the last week, where there's been all sorts of unhelpful and threatening language that's been used, a whole range of negatives. And you think, well, actually, just put a sock in it and just get on with it rather than critiquing all the time. Of course, we need to hold government to account and we need to review so that we can refine and improve our practice. I absolutely agree with that approach. It's a fundamental principle on which public health practice is based on. But, you know, we're in the middle of a crisis. Let's get on with it and deal with it.
And I think, Misha, one of the other things, Tass, you know, we touched on, there's been a lot of comment, you know, we want government, you know, to really help us out with this and to get it right. We've seen in every state and territory, and, you know, some with Liberal governments, some with Labor governments, that the opposition in those places makes comment. Well, actually, the two oppositions. You know, you have the formal opposition and then you actually have the Greens. And, you know, I was watching what was going on down at the Towers, and a lot of criticism, partisan criticism, which at the base of it there was some good points, but what were the alternatives that were offered?
Yeah.
There wasn't actually an alternative. Well, actually, this is what we should have done. And, you know, for me, I want to see, if you're going to criticise, that's fine. But what would you do? What do you suggest?
What do you think, Misha?
Yeah.
I think that's right. And I also think you've got to really watch this idea of stigmatising certain groups in the community and, you know, being sort of hostile at a time when they're sort of under a form of threat and have a need. There's actually a terrific series of articles that has just been released in The Guardian, produced by the Scanlon Foundation. It's some research. It's written by James Button and Julie Zago, who are two former Fairfax 9 writers. And it's about interviewing people in high-rise housing commission accommodation about their experiences of it. And part of what they're doing is focusing on the positive, the experience of that public housing and the benefits, some of the sense of the community, which I think is really important. It's not just about, you know, scoring cheap political points. It's about a real understanding. And I think, you know, there are things that could come out of this that are quite positive, which is a good positive debate about how we do public housing. But what you don't want is cheap political point scoring. Mm. It's not the time for it. And it feels like there has been a lot of that about. And look, it is a fine line, but there's a fine line between constructive critique and holding government to account at a time when it needs to be held to account and it needs to be critiqued, and that sort of counterproductive point scoring critique, which there's been a bit of, you know, around the place.
There's been more than a bit. We saw the Supreme Court in the United States has come down with a recent decision basically saying that Donald Trump as president, despite his assertions that he is above the law in every regard, that he's actually not. He's an everyman, and that he has to produce his taxes to the New York Attorney General. This is a pretty big development for the old Donald, isn't it?
It is, although it's interesting that everybody's interpreting the decision to mean that the timing will be that the tax records don't come out until after the election.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the political implications are perhaps less strong than the broader implications, which are the court, in a pretty resounding 7-2 decision, said that, rejected the argument, really, that the president, by virtue of the office, should be exempt from the normal functionings of the criminal legal process. You know, the argument that was put was that because of the nature of the role of the president and because of the fact that, you know, you might have vexatious litigants or people who are politically motivated using the processes against somebody in that office, that there should be some sort of, you know, exemption or immunity or special treatment. And that was very strongly rejected by the Supreme Court. You know, it was very much an argument that even the president is subject to the ordinary rule of law and the ordinary court processes.
And it was interesting that a couple of justices in that judgment were justices that
he appointed
that he probably thought, oh, they're going to be in my corner. Well, guess what, Donald? They actually are looking at the law as it should be interpreted, not as you think it should be interpreted.
It's interesting, and it's sort of, it's a good explanation, or it's a good sort of reminder of the limits of partisanship. So much of US politics, so much of, to some extent, you know, what people cheer the particular presidents do, from, you know, people engaged in partisan politics in the US, is about getting people from their side of politics on the Supreme Court. Yeah. The way in which they see the Supreme Court in the US is very much more through a political lens than, for example, in Australia or in other countries, where there is, although you would see certain sides of politics will appoint certain types of judges more broadly, there is more of a developed sense of the sort of independence of jurists. And it's good to see that, you know, even in the US system, which is so sort of dominated by this partisan way of thinking, that there is a bit of independence and capacity to look at the issue, you know, and vote against what you might expect from sort of a partisan lens.
And I think what you're seeing, and you look at the history of a lot of these justices, and even go back to Franklin Roosevelt, you know, in every president since, that often the judges, more often than not, the judges that they've appointed to the Supreme Court, including chief justices, and pretty much on the basis they thought that they would be in their corner, and almost universally they've been found in a lot of really important cases to actually not be in anyone's corner, to actually be in the corner of the law.
Yeah, and to me, I mean, that's the system working the way it should and the way you want it to.
Yeah.
You know, the bit I find disappointing is when the system actually is gripped so much by the partisanship that people aren't thinking independently. Because then you sort of have to ask yourself the question, what's the point of having all those individual human beings, separate minds, judging things if the outcomes are predetermined?
Mm.
One of the criticisms that's made of Parliament in Australia, for example, is that the party political system, which is not formally acknowledged in the Constitution, but yet is, you know, is really the way the system runs, means that so many parliamentary debates are, the outcomes are predetermined by who has the numbers and what people are going to say. So that idea of having, you know, 150 people in the House of Reps as individuals making their own individual judgments isn't really what you're getting. And, you know, on something as important as, you know, the Supreme Court or the High Court in Australia, it's just nice to see people making individual independent judgments. I think that's really, you know, heartening.
We're getting lots and lots of feedback this morning, Misha, on our screen. Lots of feedback on some of the commentary that's made, and people are actually, I think if I was to identify a key theme that's emerging in the commentary, is that people are actually saying that they're a little bit tired of the negativity and are disgusted, it's a language that's used in one of the messages here, disgusted with, you know, what appears to be sort of very negative speak, rather than constructively trying to get on with it. So
that brings us to negative partisanship, doesn't it, Taz?
Yes, what does that mean?
Well, I don't know. Misha, you guys have done some things on, you know, some pieces on this. Explain to us what it is, just so listeners know.
So it's sort of this idea, and it really applies more to the US political system, that in a system where voting is voluntary, as it is in the US, the idea of a swinging voter, the person who you're going to convince, the sort of some person in the middle who the Democrats or the Republicans might convince to vote for one candidate or another, is somewhat overstated. And in actual fact, one of the key things you have to do is get out the base, get people to actually vote to begin with. And there's a political scientist called Rachel Bitkova, who was featured in a big piece in Politico in February this year, who's done a lot of research and modelling around the idea that one of the most powerful things to get people out to vote is negative partisanship.
Hmm.
So it's actually the idea that, for example, the Democrats are scary and beyond the pale and, you know, Hillary Clinton is horrible. And her argument is basically that's why you see so many negative ads in the US. People claim to hate them, and they do. They hate sort of attack ads. But they're also extremely powerful in terms of motivating people in a system that is very much about, you know, the different sides getting people out to vote. And she's done a lot of work. She was very good in predicting the US midterms in 2018. She's doing a lot of predictive work. And the last time I was on your program, you asked me who was going to win the US election.
Yes.
Predictions are for mugs, and I'm not going to get involved in that game. But I did think it would be worth bringing you Rachel Bitkova, who's a very good analyst on this, and she's arguing that Trump is pretty much dead in the water because his mishandling of COVID-19 has been so just palpable, and the negative partisanship work that's being done now in the US, this idea about, including from some people on the Republican side, the sort of the Never Trump impulse, means that her argument is that Biden is looking very, very strong. It's almost, you know, her argument is almost that the result is sort of pretty much predetermined now.
You don't know this, Misha, but Misha, Macca was going to ask me a little bit later on in the show what my highlight has been. I think this moment is my highlight. This is the best news that I have heard for a long time. To have a change of leadership in the US is just so necessary and so needed, in my view. So I think we need to track this Rebecca down and bring her into the studio, Macca.
I agree, and there's one thing that I think is always... Tash won't agree with this, Misha, but look at what the betting sites, when you put money on it...
No, I won't agree with you, betting,
Macca. No, and he doesn't. But Trump has still got better odds.
Really? I think that's probably incorrect. It's interesting. Rachel Bitkova is a political scientist, and that's different to people who work just purely like the data scientist. There's sort of two ways of coming at this problem.
Yeah.
But I found her analysis really compelling. I think that, you know, she knows what she's doing, and she's done a lot of detailed modelling work with the numbers. You know, obviously... You know, predictions are always subject to risk, but I think it's looking very bad for Trump right now.
Misha, I think we want to talk about one more topic before our time's up this morning: cancel culture. Cancel culture is something that I had not really understood as a concept. Could you explain to our listeners this morning what's meant by cancel culture?
Well, part of the problem is that those that use the term don't necessarily always nail it down either.
Ah.
It's sort of a vague sense from people on, you know, the right and on the left that there's a newfound censoriousness around, and if you offend certain values, you will be attacked and cancelled. So the sorts of prominent examples that are put out are, most recently, there was an editorial in the New York Times written by somebody called Tom Cotton about bringing the military to quell the Black Lives Matter protests. Now, the New York Times opinion editor who commissioned that piece lost their job, as did the deputy, when there was staff outrage over the publication of that article. And basically, there was a big debate in the US about free speech, the limits of free speech, whether it was a legitimate op-ed to run, and whether cancel culture was at play. You also get it around issues of, you know, race, sexuality, gender, all the sort of, you know, many of the issues around sort of identity politics. And what's happened recently is there's this big open letter signed by a whole bunch of very famous authors, you know, Margaret Atwood, J.K. Rowling, Martin Amis, Noam Chomsky, you know, a whole bunch of very famous people, basically decrying, and they didn't use the words cancel culture, but sort of a culture of censoriousness that is shutting down debate and diversity of opinion in the view of the people that wrote the letter. Now, there's been a huge backlash against that. People who have read the letter have said, look, the letter's vague, it doesn't say what it's talking about. And really, J.K. Rowling signed the letter, and a lot of people are interpreting it as a response which is to do with her comments about the trans community on Twitter, that have caused a lot of outrage and upset, and her sort of being somewhat thin-skinned about people criticising her. So that's the best summary I can give of it. It's a huge, complex debate playing out at the moment, really across the world. And there's an argument that there is a sort of a closing down or a closing of people's minds, an inability to countenance debate on contentious topics. From some people, there are also people who are saying that basically privileged, powerful people, you know, like famous authors, are being hypersensitive to critique.
You know, Macra and I were debating this earlier on over donuts earlier this morning, and my view is that if you are prepared to make a public comment, you are opening yourself up to scrutiny and, of course, a debate of some sort. And I also believe that our choice of language, the choice of words that we use, often reflect our values, and our values often reflect the culture in which we live in. So we need to be very careful. We need to actually think about what we say very carefully, especially if we say it publicly, because we open ourselves up to scrutiny and debate.
And there's always a danger in this mixture of being an absolutionist, isn't there, Tess?
Well, I don't see it that way, Macca.
Oh, no, of course not.
I think my sort of feeling is that there is a... Look, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, what you say should be said carefully, and you should accept criticism for it. I do think that there is sometimes in public discourse a slightly shrill aggressiveness from all sides about people with whom we disagree, and a real inability to handle nuance and handle disagreement. And, my personal view is that we just all should be a little bit kinder, a little bit more respectful. And I do sometimes worry when a criticism of somebody's position translates in sort of to an off with their head.
Yeah.
You know, they should lose their job, you know, it should be the end of their life. It seems to me that there's sometimes a level of aggression in public discourse that is disproportionate to the infractions or the things that people are said to have done wrong. But the flip side of that is that the whole idea about free speech and public debate and being willing to countenance a range of opinions, while it's really appealing and important, the reality is that it's always favoured those with power. If you look at the media more generally, it has always been, affluent, generally white, heterosexual men who dominated the public discourse. And as we get a greater range of voices, we do need to acknowledge that to some extent, that opening up, if we want to preserve that free speech idea, it has to actually serve everybody, not just a small group of people. And that small group of people who are used to dominating the public discourse have to get used to accepting criticism from a wider range of individuals.
Absolutely.
And they
absolutely
accommodate
right.
a wider range of perspectives.
So absolutely right.
Now, we're out of time, Misha. Tell people where they can connect with the conversation.
It's just theconversation.edu.au. And the one topic we didn't get to, which I did want to just touch on a little bit, was masks, which is, the policy now is definitely to encourage the use of masks. We've got a terrific article on the site which is about the different types of masks. And if you are making one, thinking about making one, what you need to think about. So I'd recommend that.
Okay.
I encourage people to read it. So the conversation... .edu.au is where you'll get the facts, unlike Where the Truth Goes to Die, which is News Corp's. Thank you so much, Misha. Really appreciate your time and the work you do and all your contributors create. It's a great resource, independent media. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.